Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Hunt Gather Talk podcast. I am your host, Hank Shaw, and we are sponsored by Filson and Hunt to Eat. Today is a really fun episode because I get to face one of my big blind spots, one of my areas of ignorance, and I get literally schooled by one of the best in the business. And if you know me, you suspect you are already on track to know what this topic is, and that is fly fishing. Yes, fly fishing. It is my biggest blind spot in the entire set of outdoor skills. I'm terrible at it. I've managed to catch a couple fish, but not very many. And I have been a commercial fisherman, as some of you know, and that is kind of the antithesis of fly fishing. But today's guest is April Vokey. And April Vokey runs Anchored Outdoors, and she is one of the best fly anglers I know. And so we had a little fun with this episode, and we decided to give it a title of Fly Fishing Sucks, Change My Mind. And the whole hour plus conversation that we're about to have is a great example of how you can have your ignorance pierced by someone who is thoughtful and funny and easy to listen to. So let's take it away. April Vokey from Anchored Outdoors. It is a pleasure to actually have you on my podcast because I believe I've been on yours and we have done other video audio kind of internet series of tubes, chance encounters over the last year. But this is going to be all kinds of fun because as anybody who knows me knows, I'm not exactly a fly angler and you are among the, I think you might be the best fly angler I've ever talked to. Which could
probably just the most well-known one. I wouldn't call myself the best at anything.
But I really want to get a little bit into fly fishing here. And I'm always drawn back to the amazing Hank Patterson, right?
Yeah.
The Hank Patterson video. If you guys have never out there seen it, it's on YouTube. Just type in Hank Patterson fly fishing. It's absolutely hilarious. But the short version of it, it's a comedy skit and he is pretending to be a fly fishing teacher, probably in Colorado, and he is trying to teach a bunch of Midwestern, probably Michigander bait fishermen about why they should fly fish. And I'm totally the Midwestern bait guy. Like, I'm here to use worms and kill fish. And fly angling for the last, I don't know, 500 years, ever since Isaac Walton figured it out, has been not that. And I kind of want to talk about that. I also want to talk about where it's really effective and more effective than conventional gear. And I also want to talk about if someone is, to use Hank's term, fly curious, how do you even get started in this whole thing? But I kind of want to know, are you originally from Canada and then you live in Australia? And I also kind of want to know, where did your journey with fly fishing start?
Yeah, well, just hearing you say that hurts my ears because yes, I'm very much Canadian. I love Canada. I would still be living in Canada. And I still do live part of the year in Canada, but over the last year and a bit with COVID, we have not been able to leave Australia. So, I had met my husband almost 10 years ago now on a fishing trip in Norway and we fell in love. And as it would be, we decided to split our year between both countries. And so here we are, part of the year in Australia and part of the year in Canada.
I mean, if you're going to be trapped somewhere, I mean, Australia is not so bad, eh?
Oh, look, I love Australia, but I really love and miss Canada. I've got my place is up on the Bulkley River, the northern BC, and that's my happy place. So I love Australia and I'm very, very thankful to be here, but I do miss home.
That's kind of where all those episodes of Alone take place, isn't it? That northern British Columbia kind of area?
I think so. It makes sense. It's pretty rugged up there, or it can be, depending on how high you go.
Are you from there, actually, in that part of British Columbia?
No, I'm from closer to Vancouver. Watch me stutter. Anyone who knows where I'm from will understand. I'm from Surrey, British Columbia, which probably isn't so bad now, but back in the day, you'd be very cautious telling people you were from Surrey. It's cleaned up a lot since I grew up.
Wait, there's a bad neighborhood somewhere in Canada?
Oh, yeah. But there's a few of them. Yep.
So how did you get started with fly fishing? It sounds like it's something that you've been doing your whole life.
Yeah, well, yes and no. You know, my parents were always pretty outdoorsy in the way that on the weekends we'd go and visit the country. We'd go out to the country. We'd go to the Chilliwack River. We'd skip rocks and we'd go to the beach and pick up sand dollars. but they didn't really fish. You know, Dad and I, every year we would go to a lake and troll worms and all that fun stuff. But it was actually, you know, kind of going full circle. It was because of growing up in Surrey that I started fishing. So, you know, I'd always loved fishing as a kid. And when my friends were naughty and started to get worse as I got older, as it happens as you're a teenager, I needed to escape it all. And so that's what I did. I chose to go fishing instead of getting in trouble.
I don't know. I managed to do both quite well, actually.
Yeah, some people do. For me, I go hard or go home. And I was either going to be dead or become a professional fly fisher. And so I opted for that.
Okay. So you're in your teenage years and you're like, I want to go fly fishing. So how does that even start?
Well, I didn't start as a fly fisher. I started as a conventional, as a spin fisher, as we do, and was obsessed with it. And then we, you know, busted a couple spinning rods on salmon and then saved all my money to buy my first bait caster, which was a huge deal for me. And then from there, caught a ton of fish and started to become bored, turned to centerpin fishing and fishing spoons. That's the thing. It's not together, not spoons on the centerpin, but I would fish spoons. And then I also started fishing the centerpin. And I just was really fascinated by both of those things. So with the centerpin, I, you know, had to adjust my line, which is really, looking back now, I was mending and getting familiar with the proper drift. And then with swinging spoons, it was just a whole new universe, right? You know, you have to really understand the action of your spoon in the water. You have to understand currents and really working it. And that was what got me into fly fishing was I knew that that was kind of, I was starting to get bored and that was the next step. So for years, I think probably for 2 or 3 years, let's see, going through my teens. Yeah, probably 2 years at least. I would go through with a fly first, and then I would go through with my bait caster after to see what I'd missed. So I was able to really learn a lot going.
That's interesting. So let me stop you for a second. So a center pin, I believe, is some peculiar to British Columbia. I believe I fished with them once. It's kind of what you guys troll with. It's this weird, trippy reel that,
like a mooching reel, kind of.
Yeah, it's super weird. I'm like, why on earth do you guys use this? Like, well, it makes it more sporting. Like,
well, no, okay. it's just more of a connection, right? So there's no real drag. So you're using your pinky finger as your drag.
Yeah.
So what that lets you do is it lets you have a truly drag-free drift with your dink float or your styrofoam float. So
we were trolling them.
Oh, yeah. No, I know. They look, the mooching reels look like that out on the boat, but in the river, that's what it's for. I wouldn't say it's necessarily, I mean, yes, it is more sporting, but for me, it was just about being more connected.
Gotcha. So interesting. So it's almost like archers, you know, you start with a rifle and then you move to archery and you start with conventional gear and then move to fly angling.
Yeah, in a lot of ways. I think I always have this bit of a roadblock with the sporting aspect because I'm going to throw myself under the bus here, but I wouldn't call myself sporting. I don't do anything because it's more sporting. I might do it because it's more fun. I might do it because I feel like it's going to be more effective. I might do it because it's what's there, but I wouldn't call myself sporting. Same with shooting a bow. I mean, I'm a bow hunter and I wouldn't say it's because I'm sporting. For a long time, I couldn't get my firearms license here in Australia. So I just, that was my option. For a few years, I hunted with my baby on my back. Well, it only made sense to do that with a bow.
Oh, so, come on. Babies love rifle fire.
I did take her on a pheasant hunting trip. I had a friend who walked with her behind us and she didn't mind it, but she really loved bow hunting.
You're going to get a gunshot kid if you shoot around him too early.
Right. Yeah. No, but no, I wouldn't call myself. I think that you can take the same shot on a deer at 20 yards with a gun and have it be clean and more predictable. But yeah, I wouldn't call myself sporting. So fly fishing for me was never sporting, maybe a challenge in a lot of ways, but it wasn't to be sporting. So I've just thrown myself under the bus there.
I can tell you pretty much the two times I've been fly angling, and I learned how to do it in Alaska. And we're, you know, of course, the obligatory first thing that everybody catches when they use a fly rod in Alaska is a pink salmon. And yes, it actually was in the mouth. So that was yay. And then, but we're looking for Dolly Varden and it was cool. Like I have to say it was cool, but I then switched to a MEPS and just murdered him. And that for me, that was so much more fun. However, there was another trip in Canada, of all places. So I am hanging out with, you know, I think you know Kevin Kosiwan. So Kevin Kosiwan and I and his friend Jeff Singer, we're all doing backcountry trout fishing in the Alberta Rockies. And again, I have a little flipping stick and they've got fly rods. And Kevin knows how to use a fly rod and Jeff was still learning. And for days, they couldn't buy a fish. They just could not buy a fish. And I was continuously catching things with, you know, various little spoons and lures and things. Until, and this is probably, you're going to be able to sort of launch off of this one. Until we went to a very placid alpine lake way up in the Canadian Rockies. And it was just completely a glass mill pond. And little brook trout were rising. Then I couldn't buy a bait. There was no way that they were going to take any of these spinners or any of these lures or anything I threw. I threw like 16 different things at them and I could not buy a bait. And Kevin over there is catching fish after fish after fish until finally you can cheat with conventional gear. You can actually have, it's like a bobber that allows you to throw a fly. I forget the exact name of it. You probably know the name of it, but it's how to cheat with a spin rod and throw a fly. And then I finally started to catch fish, but this is the first time, and I had been in and around fly anglers for 30 years. It's the first time that I had ever seen someone with a fly outfish me. And so I was like, huh, okay. So there definitely is at least one instance in which a fly gear is significantly more effective than conventional. Can you think of others?
Yes, I can. Now that is the most obvious one. And I'm happy that that happened to you so that you were able to see how real of a situation that is. In a lot of lakes, just before I even go to rivers, in a lot of lakes, that's exactly the case. Fish eat bugs. And, you know, taking it one step farther, the aquatic stage of a midge fly is what we call a chronomid. And I remember trolling the lake with my dad with worms and, you know, wedding bands and willow leaves, and we could not get a bite. You know, you get a bite, but it wasn't anything that you'd write home about. But when I learned about chronomids, my whole life changed. And it makes sense. I mean, the chronomid makes up in some lakes like 70% of a fish's diet. I think we literally just published our Brian Chan, who is the authority on this, his masterclass. We filmed a masterclass with him. And he says, if you pick up 6 inches of mud off the bottom, there will be 600 to 700 species of chronomids in that 1 6-inch section. And so for a large part of the year, the fish really just hone in on those chronomids. Now, a chronomid is tied on a hook the size of an eyelash, literally looks like an eyelash. It's almost impossible to imitate that with something that you'd buy at, you know, your standard tackle shop. It's going to be really hard to cast. You might be able to cheat with what you were saying with the bobber, but at the end of the day, it's still a little fly that you're using. And you know, let's start kind of going up from there. Then you factor in mayflies and sedges and damsels and dragons and all of the aquatic life that goes on in the lake. That's what the fish are feeding on. You could troll a worm and not catch anything. You know, same with leeches, all these anglers fishing leeches, they don't understand why they're not working at 3 o'clock in the day. They work in the morning, they work in the evening, but typically in the middle of the day, the fish are honed in on bugs. So if you can't properly imitate that, then you're not going to catch as many fish. So that's a long-winded way of saying, yes, you want a fly fish to imitate bugs. For people who don't understand fly fishing, I just want to put it into perspective. So when you're fishing a lure or even bait, right, you're using the weight of the lure, the weight attached somehow to your bait to deliver your hook to the fish. Mm-hmm. But with fly fishing, your entire fly line is weighted. So the average fly line is, say, 90 feet long, but you need to really only look at the first 30 to 40 feet of that fly line. So the 30 to 40 feet of fly line that are out of your rod tip, they have this taper to them that acts as a pendulum. And the taper is weighted in what we call grain weight. So they've got this condensed amount of grain weight in the front that really helps to, like I said, act as a pendulum and load your rod to help you deliver your fly to the fish. So in a situation where you're fly fishing, you can have 30 to 40 feet of weight extended out of your rod tip and on the water rather than, you know, the 8 ounce or whatever weight of lead it is that you're chucking out with your bait, if that makes sense. So the taper is a lot more gentle. So in conventional fishing, when you try to cast your lure or your bait with a weight, then it's going to have a plop. It's going to definitely disturb that nice milky alpine lake setting that you were talking about. Mm-hmm. Because with a fly line, you're tapered out for so long that it can really have this gradual and gentle landing. There's hardly any movement on the water. It's just very stealthy. Hmm. Fly fishing is very, very sneaky and very stealthy. So that's the first situation. I don't know how far you want to go down this rabbit hole, but.
So the other one that I know, because I've seen it, is really tiny little like switchbacks in really small water. Like really, like water I would never fish, you know, ever. Like I wouldn't fit like, oh, great, I'm not going to fish it. But a fly angler can and will fish it and will have results.
Right, because they're matching the hatch. And so that's really all it comes down to is matching the hatch. I would love to see you try to match the hatch with a mayfly. Again, people who don't know what these are little flies that as they emerge, they come to the top of the water and say they're floating on the water. We might, as fly fishers, use a fly that's tied out of deer hair, which will float on the surface. And because we have our gradually tapered fly line, we can land it without any noise and it's all very stealthy. How would you, Hank, in that situation, they're constantly feeding, very obviously feeding on mayflies on the top of the water. What would you do?
It's probably why I don't fish for trout.
Right. Okay.
I actually don't fish for trout all that much because trout, I mean, I fish for salmon and trout kind of bore me sometimes. And I think that's what might be one of the reasons why is because I can't tell you how many times I've been in these small mountainous places where like, oh yeah, there's trout here. There's zero way I'm going to get them to bite. So I'm moving on.
Okay. Well, let's go to bass. Do you like fishing for bass?
You mean ditch pickles?
Oh, ouch.
Yeah, I mean, I've ripped the lips off of any number of a big old large and smallmouth bass.
Okay, well, let's talk about that for a second. Now, I know that obviously you're going to catch more fish with like gulps, okay?
Well, sure. I mean, I can probably outfish most people with Berkeley power bait for trout too.
Well, not for trout. If we had to have a competition on a trout lake and you had power bait and I had flies, I would bet you money that you'd be out fishing with flies.
That would be fun. It'd be fun either way because we're both going to catch fish. You'll probably just catch more.
We'll have a look. Yeah. I mean, if you pump a fish's stomach and you see what they're feeding on, it's hard to go. Like once you've seen that, you never go back. But let's talk about bass for a second. You know, I love trick fishing. I love fishing over logs and lily pads and trying to bounce my fly off of rocks and all that fun stuff. It can be hard to do that with something that's got weight to it. Whereas again, because we've got our weight in our fly line and not in our fly, I can be fishing a large foam popper and land my entire fly line over a bed of lily pads. And then if I have a weed guard on my fly, be able to retrieve it in a way that I'm not snagging anything. I'm not sinking anything with a weight. It's all, again, super stealthy and on top of the water. I understand that you can fish a lot of these lures that won't get hung up.
Like a weedless frog.
Yeah, absolutely. But you still have to be able to get that frog to the lily pads. And you almost always are going to have a chunk of weight of some sort or have the frog itself be really heavy. Mm-hmm. So it can be, you know, if you try to just tie on a truly weightless frog, it's going to be a lot harder to cast the distance that you could with a fly line.
Right, right.
I don't know about you, but I can't cast light weights very far on my spinning rod.
I've gotten good at it because, you know, I don't know if you've ever used like 4 pound or 6 pound braid.
Yeah.
But that's basically like a hair and you can chuck that with almost nothing on the end of it.
Yeah, depending on how heavy. But then again, if you have a super, super light lure, it just gets tricky. I mean, maybe you're more talented at a time, but it can. That's one situation. Here's another situation. So When you're fly fishing, I'm standing in the front of the boat. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, we have a bass boat, so we're in the boat and I'm standing on the bow of the boat. We've got the electric down. I'm picking apart a shoreline and I know that I'm about 40 feet off the shore. So I'm going to peel off 40 feet of line off my reel. That's going to let me be consistent every single cast. Whereas when you're fishing a spinning rod or a spinning reel, yeah, I mean, you're a talented angler knows when to stop. obviously, you know when to put your finger down and right. when to not let any more line come out. But with fly fishing, you just remove all of that. You've got 40 feet of line out. You know you've got 40 feet of line out. Game on, go. So that makes it simple too. But if you want to go to the ocean, and I bring this up because this, excuse me, was something that came up in a comment section a few days ago on my Instagram. I was fishing for tuna and other fish that, you know, where you're looking for birds and trying desperately to get to them before they go down.
Right.
And somebody had said the fly rod's not the right tool for the job. But in that situation, now understand, I'm in the Kimberley in way north, far north Australia. I am surrounded by all my tools. I've got my spinning rods on one side and my fly rods on the other. And I'm going to pick up whatever makes the most sense. In that situation, the fish are up, down, up, down, up, down. Every time you turn around, they're, you know, behind you or in front of you. And I just simply couldn't keep up spinning fast enough to like retrieving fast enough with my spinning reel to be able to re-deliver the fly. I mean, sorry, my bait, my plastic. Whereas with the fly rod, you don't need to reel in that line to pick up and recast. So I can, standing on the top of a boat or on the bow of a boat with that much space between me and my line, I'd say I can pick up and re-deliver 45 feet of line out of my rod tip. So even though I've just made a cast to the fish at 1 o'clock and I've got 40 feet of line out, I don't need to worry about reeling that 45 feet of line out to recast to the fish that are now, you know, behind me at 6 o'clock. All I have to do is pick up and lay it down. And it took a fraction of the time that it would to reel that line. And so for me, that's a major, because I do a ton of saltwater fishing in Australia. And even before I moved here, I spent a lot of time fishing the flats. And being able to pick up a fly line and re-deliver it quick smart is a huge advantage when it comes to whether or not you should fly fish.
That's an interesting one. I did not know about that one. And it, because I do know that, you know, I used to fish Long Island all the time, and there's a really legendary trifecta that everybody tries to do out of Montauk. And it's a bonita, it's a striped bass, and it's a bluefish all in one day on the fly, which, you know, it's not really hard to do with a conventional gear, but it's very hard to do with a fly because, you know, A, it's just, you know, you got to get lucky because you got to get them all relatively close to the surface. And they do, all three of them will go relatively close to the surface. But yeah, I mean, I've watched it and like, I'll admit it does look like a ton of fun when you've got a bonita on the end of your line.
Yeah. It's not always the right tool for the job. And I think that's where we start to run into problems, or there's this horrible stereotype of fly fishing snobs who are just out of touch with reality.
Quick shout out to one of our sponsors, eFish. They deliver fresh, never frozen, wild, American caught day boat seafood right to your doorstep. What's unique about eFish is that they don't have a warehouse full of fish. They simply connect you straight to the source. This means that in most cases, your product is still swimming when you place an order. Their business operates in the same way. I order fish from my fishermen friends across the country. The fish goes straight from the dock to you overnight. It doesn't get much fresher than that unless you catch it yourself. With eFish, you can always be sure that your fish is ethically sourced, never treated with chemicals, and is handled with care from the minute it is hooked until it arrives in your doorstep. The holiday season is upon us, and now is the perfect time to try eFish. Whether you're cooking for your friends and family, or you want to send a unique and memorable gift to a distant loved one, eFish has you covered. From stone crab claws to lobster to halibut, eFish will elevate any holiday feast. They have even curated special holiday bundles that will ensure that no one at your dinner table was left hungry. So if you want to try fresh seafood for the holidays, check out eFish.com. That is e-fish.com. Get $15 off your first order with the code HUNTGATHERTALK. That is HUNTGATHERTALK, all one word. And again, check out e-fish.com.
I believe if you want to be a well-rounded angler, that you need to be able to know how to do all of it. You know which tool is the best tool for the job. And I think that when we start to be fly fishing only, or only, you know, fly fishing snobs, that really takes away from and discredits the skill of people who are talented on a spinning rod. Because, I mean, my husband is the most talented soft plastics fisherman I've ever seen. And that sounds like, I've even said that before and had people laugh. And I look at them like, what, why is that funny to you? He is beyond talented. And there is a talent to fishing spinning reels and fishing soft plastics and all those crazy expensive, like $50 lures that cost a fortune when you bust them off.
Right. You're talking about Arapalas and broken backs and things like that.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I just think as well-rounded anglers, we need to know how to do it all. And it's funny because, you know, I believe I'm the angler I am today. And again, going back to the beginning, I'm not the best, but I'm not going to downplay it. I know how to fish. Mm-hmm. And I think it's because of fishing my bait caster and fishing a spinning rod all those years. I really, really believe they made me a better angler.
It's interesting. I just never, yeah, and I'll tell you why sort of the origin of my origin story with fly fishing is, so I grew up in New Jersey and there is trout fishery in, you know, the Kittatinnies and in the Watchungs, or at least there was, you know, 40 years ago. So you could fish trout there. And so I used to go to a spot, Bound Brook in New Jersey, which, you know, a zillion years ago had trout in it. They're probably all dead now, but, and you could catch five a day. That was the limit. And so I was spin casting with, you know, various lures, sometimes actual bait. This is before Berkeley Power Bait, so then worms. And the Orvis boys would always show up, and they were all rich guys, and they were all decked out in stuff that I could never afford. And they would literally yell at me. Now, mind you, I'm like 14.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm like a young teenager, and all I'm doing is trying to catch some fish for dinner. And they're literally yelling at me to get the hell out of here. I mean, and that's a nice way to put it. That's not exactly what they said. And don't touch their fish. And this happened like a half a dozen times until finally it's like, you know, you guys can go kick rocks with sandals. I'm just going to go to down the shore. And this is before I think I'd even heard of, and I don't think it was really too popular, fly angling in the 70s and early 80s, saltwater at least. And I never saw a fly angler on the salt. I mean, not when I was a kid. So I'm like, God, I got away from those sons of bitches. And like, I've had a kind of a chip on my shoulder about them ever since. And it wasn't until I moved west, and I moved west in 2004, because I'd met a few fly anglers in Minnesota when I lived there. And, you know, I think the Minnesotans are kind of more like you are. They're sort of practical about it. They're like, yeah, I'm going to troll for walleye and then I'm going to fly fish for things. And it's just, we're going to do a various mix of things. But I did not meet an exclusive fly angler who was not a douche until I moved west, because then I realized, oh, okay, there are fly anglers who A, eat their fish, which is a big deal for me. Yeah. You know, I don't know if you know this about me, but I'm about as anti-catch and release as you can get. I have some exceptions to that. And one exception, and this actually fly angling fits into this as well. I was up on God's River, which I don't know if you've ever fished. It's in northern Manitoba.
No.
And God's River is the home of like the world's largest brook trout. It's nuts. It's just nuts. I caught 5 brook trout over 4 pounds in one day. And one of the biggest was 7.2 pounds. 7.2 pound brook trout. That's a big ass brook trout, right? So, I mean, I was using a low profile bait caster and chucking Rapalas and just murdering them. And I mean, the fly anglers caught fish. Don't get me wrong. They did well too. But me and my friend, Shel Zolkovich, she's from Gimli, which is Lake Winnipeg. So she and I both use conventional gear and just have a blast at the time. But at the end of that day, I did realize that, okay, I'm 95% sure that there would not be that many big giant trout up in God's River if it wasn't 100% catch and release. That said, God's River is a special place. You have to fly into it. It doesn't get much pressure. Even, you know, it's barbless hooks. It's cold. Even in summer, it's pretty cold. So you have kind of ideal situations for catch and release where I am very happy to see that the state of California right now, because we're in a drought and it's hot, kind of puts it's not the law, but it's kind of the law where they basically are begging people to stop fly fishing for trout after like 9 a.m. because it's just too hot and they all die.
Yeah, I agree.
Quick shout out to one of our sponsors, and that is Filson. Anybody who knows me knows that I wear Filson because Filson doesn't break. It isn't cheap, but neither should it be because it lasts forever. And one of the greatest things that I have of theirs is their Mackinaw jacket. If you're not familiar with this jacket, it is a kind of like a heavy boiled wool overcoat that you can wear anywhere from kind of cold to really cold. And for over 120 years, Filson has been the most trusted outfitter for this kind of outdoor sport, trade, and adventure wear. And for almost as long, they've been making that Mackinaw cruiser jacket. Originally patented way back in 1914, this jacket has become a legend in its own right, spanning generations as the hallmark of an outdoor coat. Made in the United States, its heavyweight, all-wool body has classic snap flap pockets and a full-width rear pocket that I use as a game vest when I go grouse hunting. This jacket has often been imitated and never been matched. They last forever. I've had mine for at least a decade, and I know some that have lasted for many decades. Shop at Filson.com for the new limited edition green and black plaid Mackinaw jacket. I have the forest green, but the green and black plaid sounds every bit as cool. Thanks to Filson for helping to sponsor this show. Back to it. So yeah, people who like fly anglers who actually eat their fish, good. Fly anglers who never eat their fish, we might have to agree to disagree on that one.
Well, there's a number of things on this. You've just thrown me a few things here. So for starters, I would like to just bring you back to your day as a kid, because that's exactly what happened to me. And see, when I was younger, because remember, I was 16 out there and I was alone. This was back in the day before. So I'm almost 40 now. So it was when there were no smartphones. And when you were out of service, you were out of service. And there were very few women out there fishing. And as far as I could tell, none who were out there alone. So I wore my hair up in a baseball hat and was real frumpy in my neoprenes and all that fun stuff. And so I looked like a boy fishing from anyone who is behind me. So I was also fishing my bait at the time. And these two fly guys came up behind me and they spoke loud enough for me to hear them. And I'm like a kid. And that they, oh, that effing bait guys ruined this whole pool. Let's get out of here. And I just felt so stupid, you know, because you're young, you're insecure. And I just felt so stupid. And that sort of behavior continued. And it made me rebel for probably 4 years. I was pretty rebellious with my old spinning rod. And it's one of the reasons I think that I continue to bring it with me to the river was I didn't want to be lumped into the fly guy scene, because I wasn't liking what I was seeing in that scene. Now, don't get me wrong. There's a lot of dickhead bait guys too.
Oh, 100%.
No one party is completely innocent. But I just, yeah, it's so damaging. And I vowed when I started fly fishing that I would never make anyone feel like that. That was really important. And that's why I still believe that we need to, you know, be respectful to the bait guys. Communication seems to solve most of these things, but
it's funny that I don't know if it's because you're a woman or if you're Canadian or maybe a little of both, that you're like, oh, I felt really bad when you're like, I was going to throw hands with these sons of bitches. I mean, I was, you know, I'm also from New Jersey and a dude. So I'm like, you know, you better back the F off. Otherwise this is going to happen. Yeah, so it's an entirely different response, but the same stimulus, I guess.
Yeah, no, I think I just, and also, you know, you're out there alone and it's so quiet and there's no one there. And I'll be honest, when someone would come by, especially back then, it was almost like, oh, cool. Part of my tribe. Let's talk and get to know each other a bit.
Yeah, that's got
to
be.
Once I figured out they weren't psycho. Like if anyone, I have had such scary situations where it's like, I'm just going to keep pretending like I'm a boy over here. But once you feel like the person's not nuts or they have a cool dog and they're your tribe and then they hate you and they don't even know you. It was just a real bummer. It never made me feel good about myself. Especially because I was trying to escape those sorts of idiots in the city. And then to go and find them out there. But now let's get back to your catch and release point, because that's really interesting to me. I think a lot of catch and release anglers need to understand, especially in lakes like brook trout, what you're talking about. A lot of these lakes need you to take your fish so the fish can get big.
Well, God's River is a river system, so that's a little different.
Oh, yeah, okay.
I totally get about lakes.
In British Columbia, keep your fish. It just boggles my mind that people don't understand that the fish won't get bigger if you keep putting all the fish back. You know, you need to be selective. But yeah, I go back and forth on that. It's funny. I was so pro catch and release. I'm still pro catch and release in some ways, but I'm a lot more conflicted and confused by it now. And it wasn't until I started hunting that the confusion really set in, because I was always a catch and keep. Like for salmon, I would keep my salmon. Simple as that. With trout, if it made sense, I kept my trout. In the ocean, there's certain fish that I kept. I was selective, but I would go out just for catch and release days. Or for, let's talk wild steelhead, for example. You know, I'd go fishing for wild steelhead in British Columbia, knowing full well that I could not keep that fish legally and it had to go.
Did you guys have hatchery fish up there too?
We do. And that's what I had cut my teeth on. You know, I learned, I started bait fishing on the Vetter and Chilliwack River. It's the same river separated by a bridge. And that's what we, you know, I was a salmon junkie. And so I would be really depressed by the time, as soon as the coho started to fizzle out, I'd be like, well, what am I going to do now? And then I learned about steelhead. And so that's what I'd be going out looking for, hatchery steelhead.
Yeah.
And then obviously you catch wild steelhead and then you become obsessed with steelhead. Or at least I
did. Oh, you got it. You got it. There's a spray for that, you know.
Yeah. I wish I had it back then. It would have saved me a lot of time and money.
So, I discovered steelhead. I knew they existed in the Great Lakes when I lived back there, but I never fished for them because you fish for steelhead in the Great Lakes when it's ungodly horrible out. Like, you know, full on, you know, Arctic survival suits and you're throwing a lure 400,000 times. So I'm like, yeah, no, I'm going to pass on that. And I'm going to fish for cod where there's a cabin and coffee. And then I moved out here where we don't have very cold winters and steelhead's a big deal, even 5 miles from my house in the American River. And I've done it. I've done it maybe, I don't know, 24 times. And I do like it. I'll admit that I like fishing for steelhead in those beautiful places that they live. And I'm hoping to connect with a wild one because they are truly very, very different from a hatchery fish.
And yeah, they're pretty
amazing. I really want a hatchery to come home with.
Yeah, right. Well, the thing is, for me, it was money. I just didn't have the money. I didn't have a boat and I didn't have any other way to access. I just wanted to fish 365 days a year.
Man, you're more hardcore than I am.
it was scary. My late teens and all of my 20s into my early 30s was scary. It was all I wanted to do. I was obsessed with it. I still love it, but I mean, I was unhealthily obsessed with it. And so to fish every day and not have any money, which is, they go hand in hand, mm-hmm. you're on foot a lot. And so you have this amazing buzz of the salmon season. And then what else do you do after that? So to stay on foot is just steelhead got me. But it wasn't until I started hunting that I started questioning why I was putting fish back. It just started to feel weird. It was this psychological shift of, why am I doing this again? I mean, I know I still will do it and I'm missing going home. And I think the first thing I'm going to do when I get home is go stand in I live on the Bulkley River. I'm going to go stand in the river and try to catch a steelhead to let it go. But I at least have the awareness and the ability to admit that it's completely selfish. It is 110% selfish. I would have argued that, look, and once upon a time, I would have told you, look, I'm doing this to bring awareness to wild steelhead. I want people to know about them. I want people to see them. I want people to know they're special. And that argument worked 10 years ago, 15 years ago. But people know about them now and they know that they're special now and they don't need to see one in my hands to know that. So I think the first step is admitting and at least acknowledging that it is selfish. And then from there, asking yourself why you're okay with being selfish.
That's a really interesting point because as you're talking, I'm thinking, oh, you know what? I had this kind of interesting opposite view because I don't do this catch and release. So my mom, she's a Yankee from Gloucester, Massachusetts. And the philosophy from that part of the world is use it up until it's worn out and don't get another until you finish the last one. And so I specifically have one box freezer that's not terribly big and my kitchen freezer. And when those are full, I stop.
Right.
And I desperately want to fish more. I desperately, desperately, desperately want to fish. If I could, and I really could, but I just don't because I have some discipline. I could fish 4 days a week on the ocean and just have a blast and have the time of my life. And maybe that's what retirement looks like. However, if I do that, I need to have this gigantic net where I basically need to be a fish market, you know, for me, because it's like, I need to feed the entire neighborhood. And you know, you catch so many fish and like, I love the aspect of it. And I'll admit it. I love killing fish. Like I've done it since I was 2 or 3 years old and I love the processing. I love, you know, filleting. I love gutting. I love cooking. I love all of it. And I have to stop, you know, because I don't want to be that guy who yeah, I've got six freezers. You're like, well, dude, when are you going to eat that crap? Right? Like, if you can't eat it within 365 days, you just stop.
Oh, no, but I give it all away to friends.
You know, I mean, that's fine to an extent, but like at some point your friends are like, they see you coming and run.
Yep. Please stop giving me all your bear meat, everybody.
Yes, that.
I know you want to like kill something, but please stop doing it just so you can give it to your friends. Come on.
Oh my God. Well, unless you've got a friend who really needs it or wants it. I mean, there's exceptions to that, but still, when I was a little kid, there was no limit on bluefish. By the way, side note, have you ever caught a bluefish on the fly?
What do you call a bluefish?
A bluefish.
No, I know, but in Australia, I'm quickly learning that there are totally different. Is this an ocean fish?
Bluefish, yeah. Ocean fish? It's an ocean, basically an elongated ocean piranha. Imagine a piranha on methamphetamines, and that's a bluefish.
I'm Googling it right now as we speak. As we call our kingfish or something else for you guys.
Kingfish, I believe, is a king mackerel. Okay.
Well, no, there's another name for it too. Hang on a second.
Bluefish are an Atlantic species.
Bluefish Atlantic. Okay, cool.
I'm looking. Yeah.
But no, I don't think so.
Okay, so you have to. You 100% have to.
I definitely have not.
As a skilled fly angler. Oh, by the way, don't lip them. No matter what I tell you, because I will. Hey, just lip them. Don't listen to me. Okay. Because they will bite your finger off.
Gosh.
Especially if they're over 20 pounds, which they get to 25.
Look at their teeth. Okay, noted. Noted.
Yeah, noted. So... anyway, you have to catch one on a fly because they're just an absolute laugh riot. Well, when I was a kid, there was zero limits on them and everybody treated them like hell. So there would be literally a giant trash can, like the 55-gallon trash can sitting on deck. And we would just fill the trash can full of them. And then no ice, no bleeding, no nothing. Everybody would be like, oh, I wonder why bluefish suck. And like
they didn't eat them?
Well, we did, but like we would come home. This is getting back to the like give them to everybody. Like somebody would come home from blue fishing in the entire like 6-block area radius of where I grew up with like, oh, okay, Louie's coming back with the bluefish. So I guess we're eating bluefish tonight.
Right.
Because they don't keep and they don't freeze. And it's one of those cases where I'm glad they put limits in.
Right.
So back to fly angling. I'm not so proud to admit that one of the reasons why I still don't do it is because the learning curve seems stunningly high. And it seems like it's one of those things that, like archery, which is also something I do not do, becomes sort of lifestyle changing. You know, it's like having a dog. Like having a dog changes your entire life. The dog's got to get walked. Otherwise, you're going to have a real, you know, problem in the house. You know, if you're going to be an archer that actually wants to kill things cleanly and have some iota of ethics, you have to practice.
Yes.
And I get the sense that fly angling is very similar in the sense that it takes quite a lot of practice to be good at it.
But less with the ethics. That's the wonderful thing about fly fishing is that, you know, if you suck, then you just don't catch anything. That's or true. You catch something and you're delighted and proud that you caught something. Archery is a whole different world because that, to me, if you are not practicing your skills there, then that's just really irresponsible. But fly fishing is a lot less dangerous like that.
Right.
But yeah, it's a pretty steep curve. I have found that a lot of the high profile people who are so adamant, you know, they hate fly fishing, that they suck at it. You know, there's a little bit of that I have noticed.
Oh yeah. But I mean, I don't hate, I've gotten over my hate of fly fishing. I'm just like, I'm terrible. And I don't know.
It might not make sense for you to put that much time into figuring it out. And that's okay. You know, but it doesn't have to be. I think that we assume that it's a lot more work than it is, because I mean, I've been doing this for a long time now and I still have stuff to learn. There's always something to learn. You're never going to be the best at it.
Well, yeah.
But if you're having more fun doing it, see, I look at it as an investment. And this kind of brings me back to being selfish with catch and release. You know, why am I okay with being selfish catching and releasing right now on this particular fish? Now, I'm not catching 10 fish a day. If I catch a steelhead every couple of days to release it, I'm very happy. Why am I okay with that? Well, it's an investment into my own mental state. It does something to me. It brings me back to my teens. It brings me back to my 20s. It just does something to me. It lets me connect with something that I just admire and adore so much. And with fly fishing, I think that there's a lot of that as well. You know, it may, for some people, and this is actually clinically proven, be an investment into your mental state. Fly fishing is a form of meditation. And so it really does force you to slow down. And I'm not saying that all fly fishing is tranquil and peaceful. I mean, I've caught sharks on the fly. It's not meditative and peaceful by any means, but a lot of people do fly fish because it brings them into that meditative state. They slow down, they focus on their muscle memory, they learn to connect with themselves. And for a while, there's nothing else that they're focused on apart from the cast. So I would say it's probably not for everybody to pick up and start. Like for you, you're probably too far gone.
You know, I'm thinking is like, you know, you're just like, it's relaxing. It's just, so that Hank Patterson skit is like, you know what relaxes me? Barbecue and fish.
Right. And for everyone, it's something else. But I mean, you know, you make the decision to not have something that you have to care for. You don't have children, for example. You know, when you were on my podcast, we had spoke about that. Briefly, you know, so for some personalities, it's just not right for them. But for the new mom listening right now, who is just thinking to herself, you haven't been a new mom, so you wouldn't know this, but there are a few months there where you wonder if you're going to die because you're exhausted. And every time that you start to think for yourself or have even a little bit of space in your brain for your own thought, somebody comes and takes it from you. So for that person who feels like they're on the edge, fly fishing might be the perfect investment. So we just need to look at it from a broader perspective, in my opinion. And I was seeing a lot of that. And that's one of the reasons I started guiding. You know, I started my guiding operation. Well, I don't guide anymore, but I started my guiding operation in 2007 called, at the time, it was Fly Gal Ventures. And it was because I was watching this miracle of taking women, it started with women and then eventually turned into a co-ed operation. But watching these people who were really stressed out suddenly not be stressed out anymore. And to me, that was a really interesting observation. So fly fishing, there are advantages, obviously, when it comes to technique and being effective. Yeah. But there's also a major advantage for certain personalities who need to meditate, but don't know how else to do it.
One of the things that, you know, again, like this is when I'm thinking about this, like, huh, I wonder, I mean, obviously I had my traumatic experience as a kid, but I wonder really is because all the things that you were talking about, like feeling at peace and be meditative, I feel when I can't see land. I feel when I'm in 1,000 feet of water. I feel when, you know, I'm trolling for salmon or trying to trick, you know, a blackfish to eat a piece of green crab. And I will go fishing sometimes with no intention of like, my freezer's full. I will do this. Like if my mental state is terrible, I will call some people up and like, hey man, I'm going fishing. Do you need some fish? And if they say yes, I'm going to go because I feel good just looking at that gray on gray, you know, offshore. Like I'm so much of an ocean person. And it seems to me that, and I could be wrong, but it seems to me that in general, fly anglers are more mountain people.
It depends on a number of things. But I'd say that that's probably the most popular fly fishing. It's the biggest stigma is that fly fishing is for trout, whereas it's you can fly fish for anything.
I think a shark and a fly, like you just mentioned, must have been a riot.
Yeah, they're okay. There's a lot of really great fly fishing opportunities in the ocean. I love fly fishing for tuna. I mean, that is a talk about a thrill. Everything's fast. But I think that, again, it comes down to accessibility. You know, a lot of people who start fly fishing, especially if they're watching their dollars, they don't have access to a boat. A lot of people don't have access to boats. And so that makes a huge difference. But think about the common denominator here, right? The one thing that we all can understand. So you like watching the shoreline or watching the ocean or watching your trolling. You're focused, right? And so focus, whether it's on the sound of a, you know, I've tried to get my husband to meditate once by listening just to the sound of a broken toilet because it was shh, but it worked. He was able to meditate to the sound of this toilet. everyone does better when they have some form of meditation. I think at this point, hopefully at this point in society, we can acknowledge that meditation is healthy for human beings. And so, you know, you have that level of focus, but for some people, that isn't going to hold their attention. I know for me, especially back then, before I had a daughter and when I was younger, my brain is on drugs. I feel like I've got a crack cocaine brain. It's all over the place. And staring at a crab, it would only take me 5 seconds before I was thinking about something I had to do that day. But fly fishing, and I'd say probably bow hunting. Those are the only two things that have the ability to actually stop my brain from bouncing all over the place and actually focusing. And that's why I feel so great at the end of the day, is because they have forced me to meditate.
That's cool.
So I think it's just so dependent.
So, okay. So if somebody listening to this is like, you know what? I think I want to give it a go. How do you even start? And I mean, this is kind of for me too, because like, how do you even start? Like, even if I don't actually become a fly angler, like I kind of would like to know, like, what are like, you know, 0.0 and then to 1.0 with fly angling? I mean, is it one of these things where you need to take a class, or do you need a guide? Can you learn it by yourself?
Yes, all of the above and none of the above. The first thing is just getting it out of your head that you're going to learn this in one day, because it won't take one day, but you can be able to go out and catch a fish after a few days of practice. Obviously, I mean, I've already said it could take a lifetime. So get it out of your head that you're going to be a pro in a day, because nothing happens that fast. But there's a lot of really great settings, environments like conclaves. You know, fly shops will put on various events where you can go and try different rods and stuff, but that can be intimidating. I'll totally admit that can be intimidating. Your best bet is probably to book a day with a guide. And instructors are also helpful depending on your instructor, but they can be intimidating. There's a level of intimidation in all of this if you have the wrong person or you're turning to the wrong person. Mm-hmm. If you have a fly shop that a friend recommends, they can be really helpful, but again, they can be intimidating. So you have to ask yourself, like, what kind of person are you? You know, are you the sort of person who does better in a big group environment, or are you the sort of person who does better one-on-one? I, for me, started with a VHS tape. I'm very private. And back then, especially as a teenager, I was very insecure in a lot of ways about doing something wrong or being laughed at. And so I got a VHS tape and I sat on the edge of my bed. And then I just watched what the guy was doing in the tape. And I copied his hands with my hands. And then I got my hands on an old fly rod. My fishing buddy gave it to me because he was in his 60s and he was never going to use the old fly rod. It was an old Shakespeare, like a little glass rod. And I went with my mom to a lake because I trusted my mom and I knew she wouldn't judge me. And then I didn't try fishing. That was a big thing. I just tried casting and then just enjoyed the moment of doing it and actually being successful at it and jumping up and down with my mom squealing, and that I was able to, you know, double haul and get my line out. So for me, that was a better scenario. But I speak to some people and they do better by, you know, being surrounded by a bunch of friends at a fly fishing event that's hosted by a shop. It just depends on your personality. I will tell you this, you can learn a lot about muscle memory and casting by doing what they call pantomime casting. So that's pretending to cast with your hands. And the other thing that's a really great idea is they sell these little tiny practice indoor rods. Echo makes one of these rods.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. And so in your house, you can be watching TV. And this is how we taught our daughter to fly fish. You're just in the house casting this little tiny rod, and it does a decent job on your form and your muscle memory. And then that way, you know, you're not hurting anybody. You're not putting a lot of money out. You're not embarrassing yourself if you're worried about that. Yeah. But I'd say that the best thing that you could do is just get out there and go and do it. And if you have a friend who's willing to do it with you, that's always pretty helpful too.
Well, that's cool. I mean, you can practice in the backyard, right? We just,
Oh my gosh. Yeah. That's where I did all of my casting, in my backyard, in the room, in the street, even though doing it at the street was not great for my fly line, because you end up ruining your fly line on the concrete. But yeah. You don't need to go out and buy all the gear either. I think a lot of people assume fly fishing is a lot of casting, and that's what snobby fly fishers want you to think, but that's not realistically what it's like when you're out there. When you're fly fishing, a lot of the time you don't have room behind you. So you're doing what's called a roll cast. And a roll cast is literally taking 20 to 30 feet of your fly line, which is all you need to catch a fish. You don't need to cast very far. And you're literally just bringing your rod tip, holding it up, your hand by your ear, and you're raising your elbow up 6 inches, and you're just rolling your fly rod back down to the water. Almost like if you're doing like a chugga-chugga-choo-choo with your arm when you're playing with kids. You're just doing this roll.
I know nothing of which you speak.
Well, listen, well, just Google or like YouTube roll cast.
I was going to Google chugga-chugga-choo-choo.
I've clearly been teaching my daughter, but you know, if you just can do a roll cast.
Yeah. That's how I caught the Dolly Varden in Alaska.
That's right. Like the fish don't see you casting. And that's the thing. Is that
that's a really good way to put it.
They only see what happens when your fly is in the water. And I think, you know, looking back now, I'm getting this flood of memories coming back. But I think that was my biggest revelation, was I was so worried about my form and my loop and what did it look like in the air. It hit me one day. Oh, yeah, they can't see any of this. I need to be focused on what my fly is doing when it's in the water. And guess what? That's no different to what you're doing with your lure or your spoon or your bait.
Yeah. One of the things that I do with a low profile bait caster, and I'm sure you fly anglers do something similar, is I'll take a 5 gallon bucket out in the backyard and I will cast into the bucket over and over again.
Yeah. That's a great way. It's a great way of doing it. And I mean, if you're an accurate fly caster, then you're doing something great, because half the guys and gals I know are not that accurate and they're still catching fish. And the other thing, you know, I guided for 10 years and I'll tell you this, the majority of fish that I saw caught were caught on bad casts. And that's not a testament to the angler. It's a testament to the presentation. You know, the fly is often landing in a pile or a mess. Maybe it gives it the time to dead drift or sink or whatever it is that it's doing, but a lot of really beautiful fish are caught on very poor casts.
What was the first fish you caught on a fly? Do you remember?
A trout. Yeah, it was a trout.
Like a rainbow?
Yeah.
Ye old rainbow trout.
They're pretty easy to catch on the fly, those old rainbows, but just don't worry about what your cast looks like. I remember again when I first realized, and I would have been in my mid-20s, when I first realized that there's typically in most scenarios, there are two types of people. There are casters and there are anglers. And then there are the very dangerous few who can do both. I mean, those are the people you want to watch, right? And that's another bit of advice. Fish behind, especially in a river scenario, if the angler is fishing downstream, you know, starting at the top, working down, fish behind them, because they can't see you and you'll learn a lot by watching them. And, you know, when I realized that a lot of the great casters spend a lot of their time competing or preparing for competitions. And to do that, they're not fishing. They don't even have a hook on the end of their line. They're fishing a bit of wool. They're casting in ponds. They're casting off docks. They're casting in stagnant water. When I realized that those people are casters and they spend all of that spare time and memory space or, you know, headspace focused on their casting, it took a lot of the intimidation out for me, because I realized, oh, well, I don't want to be one of those. So I don't mind not having the perfect cast or being as good as them, because I'm on the other side of things. I'm a fisher. You know, I just want to catch more fish. So just because someone has a beautiful cast doesn't mean you have to have a beautiful cast. You have to have an efficient cast, and they're very different things.
That's exactly like duck calling. So the guys that you really want to worry about are the guys that win the meat calling contest. The grand prize goes to like this very stylized, it's almost like a kabuki, you know, dance where it's like, it's ducks don't sound like that. And then they give that trophy away. And the guys you really want to listen to are they call them the meat callers, because those are the guys that are there to kill ducks.
Right. Yeah, it sounds like it's exactly the same thing.
Yeah.
And it's not, I'm not throwing shade on one or the other. Again, I know guys and gals who have won world casting competitions who are some of the most dangerous anglers I've ever seen. They're incredible. But I also know a lot of them who I bet you they haven't put a hook on in 5 years. So it just, yeah, don't hold your standards to other people's, right?
So Anchored Outdoors does classes that can help, doesn't it?
Yeah. So I started Anchored Outdoors because of the podcast. And so I was sitting down with all these really cool people hearing all these stories. And as you would know, it was all audio. And I was getting requests to teach a lot of these techniques in video form. So I started the Anchored Outdoors membership. And that has been really exciting. Look, if you're looking to get into fly fishing, just join our membership, because you'll have complete access to me and everyone who comes on, or a lot of the guests who come on the show. So if you want to be in a safe community, just join.
Safe community. If you want to be away from like baitcaster dudes with bait like me.
Well, no. No, a lot of our members fish both, but it's a safe community. It's a safe community and a reputable community where you're not questioning if the tuition you're watching on YouTube is complete rubbish, because a lot of the stuff on YouTube is absolute garbage. But a part of the membership is we do these awesome masterclasses. I'm obviously into online education because for me, it's helped wonders with everything from investing in cryptocurrency to gardening. I love online tuition, but our masterclasses are, I'm very, very proud of them. That's where I spend all of my time and money. And we've been rocking them. They've been awesome.
I know. I did the whole one with Josh Nyland, and who actually going to be on the podcast.
Oh, good. That's great.
Yeah. It took an arm and a leg to get him on, but I finally got him on. It's just a lot of it is like, it's, you know, you and I mean, we went through like six different days to try and get it done. Cause isn't this like, you know, August 30th in Australia or something weird because of the dateline?
July 30th. We're only one day ahead of you guys.
Somewhere else in the galaxy, you know?
Yeah, exactly. No, well, that's great. You'll have a great time with him.
Cool.
The other thing I would love to see you start. One of our masterclasses is taking fish skin and turning them into leather. I'm huge in hide tanning, and Lata Ram, who is the authority in this, in fish skin tanning, teaches our masterclass on it. It is like, I was just thinking about those bluefish that you were talking about and thinking
I used to have a triggerfish wallet.
Oh, I know. It's incredible. Do you know what you could have done with all that bluefish skin? You'd have, you make shoes and purses and everything.
Oh my God. I want a jacket. I want to, if I ever win a major award again, I'm going to walk up on stage wearing a bluefish jacket.
Yes. I love it. Perfect.
Well, I will definitely put everything that we've talked about in the show notes, and you have specific links to some of the Anchored Outdoors classes, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So basically what will happen is someone signs up to be a member, and we are admittedly right in the middle of revamping our entire membership. We're putting in this really cool system where now when you take a certain section, so it's a 6-step program, which sounds like a recovery program, but it's not, it's just a results driven program. But basically now when you start at A, as you go through all the steps, you can test your learning. And then when you test your learning, you get points, which are worth money, which you can then spend on the site to buy other masterclasses and all this stuff. So the membership is currently being rebuilt, although it should be done by the time this podcast goes live or shortly thereafter.
Oh, cool.
And then when you sign up, you automatically get 2 masterclasses and a course put into your dashboard. So you get my spay casting class, as well as an on the water tips and techniques class by Justin Duggan. And that class right there is worth its weight in gold. It's worth more than the price of signing up to be a member, which is like $4.99 a month. And that class right there for a new fly fisher, you'll be so far ahead after taking his class. Not even funny. So I don't want to push it too much because I'm not into the whole pushy thing, but yeah, I will give you my word. If you come in, it's probably a great place to start. And then if you have questions, like I said, you have access to myself, our instructors, and the whole community. So you're never left hanging. And we even, one of the parts of this results point system is you can submit a video of yourself casting, which of course stays private. And then we are there to coach you and help you figure out what you need some help with. So basically you're getting a $200 consulting lesson for like $5. So,
wow. Is that $5 American or is it like $5 Canadian, which is like 38 cents American?
It's American. We're still in beta with the new membership. So that goes, I think we're raising our prices in December. So now's the time.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Well, thanks a ton for being on the podcast. This has been fun. I mean, it's like, it's almost like a therapy session where like, I know I should like this more. And
and it's okay if you don't. It's okay if you don't. But yeah, I think before you make up your mind one way or the other, you should know all the minutiae, know all the little details first.
I definitely learned a lot. Like there's a bunch of stuff that you're like, I've actually never seen that. Because a lot of times you'll see someone fly angling and it'd be like, I'm just flailing around a big heavy line. And there's a lot more to it. Even I know about mending line and da-da-da-da. But there's just... it's just a whole world that is kind of opaque if you're looking at it from the outside.
It is. And I'd say also my last note on that is if you fish conventional gear, this should not be alien to you. You already mend your line. You already understand loading the rod. You already do fish, you know, delivery of your lure to the fish. And most importantly, you already, more than anybody, including new fly fishers, you know how to work your bait or whatever it is while it's in the water. So you're already halfway there. All you have to do is do a little bit of basic casting. Hmm. You know, the people who should be a little bit more nervous are the people who have never fished a day in their lives. They have no idea what it's like to target a fish in the water. and they want to get started. That, again, you've got an advantage because you have no bad muscle memory, but I could understand being intimidated there. But if you already fish conventional gear and you know what it's like to be able to target a fish, then you're already halfway there, more than halfway there.
Kind of want to catch a tuna on the fly.
Oh, it's so much fun. And then they're so fast. You have to, you know, sometimes you'll see this. I just did an Instagram post. I've got my fly rod under my armpit. And then you've got to use two hands to strip your line as fast as you possibly can. It's chaos. It's great.
Yeah. I mean, the first big fish I ever caught was, I caught a bluefin when I was 12, I think. 12 or 13. Yeah.
Nice. Oh, nice.
Yeah, it was about 150 pounds.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Good. No, see, in a situation like that, I don't think I'd bother with the fly rod because there's an element of being fair too, right?
If you're talking about skippies too, like the smaller ones.
Yeah.
Still, that's go home. You know, everybody I know who's caught a permit or a bonita or a yellowtail jack on fly says it's just an absolute gas.
It is. Yeah.
Well, cool. Well, thanks a lot for coming on the show. And I will put all that stuff in the show notes and I will see you on the water when you can finally get back to Canada.
Yeah, right. Or when you can finally get over here, we still need to get you to Australia.
I do. Apparently I have readers in Australia, which is pretty cool. Like, you know, you never really quite know who's reading your site. I've been to New Zealand, but I've never been to Australia. And I have a theory that Australia is to the United States what New Zealand is to Canada.
Yeah, probably.
Kind of the big, loud, chest thumping, awesome country that has its own problems. And then Canada and New Zealand are the kind of like the actually more polite, more beautiful, more wildlife countries that are like, you know, they hold their, you know, they're a little bit more quiet.
Yes, but I think that you would like Australia, if not more. I love New Zealand because of obviously the majestic landscape. Yes. But Australia, it is so rugged, wild. If you go to the snowy mountains, it's one terrain. If you go to the bloody Kimberley, where the nearest road is 300 kilometers away, it's a totally different terrain. And we have introduced animals, but there's also all of this amazing natural wildlife, flora, fauna. Like it is, I honestly think if you came to Australia, you'd question going back, especially knowing how much you like ocean fishing. I think that you would find yourself in a bit of trouble here. I think
because there's so many trippy fish to catch.
It is so one end of each. It's a special place. I remember moving here and thinking, oh, I'm going to spend all my time in New Zealand. And now I'm here going, wow, this place is totally underrated.
It's a date. We'll do it.
All right. Get on over here. Cool. Well, thank you very much for having me on the show and let's stay in touch.
Absolutely.
Thanks.
That is our show for this week. I am your host, Hank Shaw, and you are listening to the Hunt, Gather, Talk podcast. Thanks again to our sponsors, eFish and Filson. As always, you can find me every single day on Instagram. I am at Hunt Gather Cook. I am pretty active on that particular social platform. And the core of what I do is, as always, my website, which is Hunter Angler Gardener Cook. You can find that via huntgathercook.com. And I have a brand new cookbook out called Hook, Line, and Supper. It is a fish and seafood cookbook. It is available wherever fine books are sold. So you can get it on Amazon. You can get it at your local bookstore. And you can get a copy of Hook, Line, and Supper signed directly from me if you go through my website. And that is huntgathercook.com. Again, have fun. Tight lines. Probably everybody listening to this right now, because it's the winter, is either hard water fishing or wearing a jacket down in the Gulf of Mexico or southern Florida. Take it easy. Be safe. Have fun. And I'll talk to you soon.